Hello, this is Larry Reedy. Welcome to my podcast. If you're a first-time listener, glad to have you here. If you're a returning listener, we have a very interesting guest tonight, Jeff Montag. And Jeff has an unusual hobby and a little side business, but we'll get into that later. So, Jeff, welcome to my podcast.
Well, thanks, Larry. It's great. Good being here.
Okay. Now, were you born in Brookville?
Well, I lived in Brookville. I was born at Christ Hospital in Cincinnati, but okay. I grew up at Brookville.
Brookville.
Yeah.
Okay. And did you go to school in Brookville?
Went to school in Brookville, yeah.
Grade school and
grade school, high school.
Okay. When you were in grade school, did you want to do anything special when you grew up?
Oh, well, a little bit of everything. It just depended on what I was doing on a given day. If I was fishing, I wanted to be a fisherman. If I was, hunting, I wanted to, do that all my life. Baseball, I wanted to be a pro baseball player.
Me too. Didn't work out.
Yeah, it didn't work out, Life happens.
Yeah. How about high school? Did you channel your thoughts more than anything then?
I wouldn't say in high school I channeled my thoughts for much of anything other than having fun.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, we talk about wondering what we're going to do in life, and I was doing a lot of wondering what I was going to do in life and not a whole lot of specific thought to what I was going to do.
Well, when I was in high school, I knew I wasn't going to go to college, so at that time, you had to have 6 years, 3 years active and 3 years inactive service, or nobody would hire you. And unless you were married and had a kid, then you wouldn't get drafted. So I had my 3 years. I started in high school, and then I went 3 years active. And but I really, until I was about 2 years in the service, I didn't really know what I was going to do when I got out. So, when you were out of high school, what was your first job?
My first job out of high school. So, when I was in high school, I actually went to vocational school and took drafting vocational school. So, I'd say my first job out of high school, I worked part-time as a draftman for Ford Motor Company in Connersville over that summer. Long enough that I decided I knew I didn't want to do that all my life. So sitting in an office and dry, it was great in high school. It was, it was fun because you have the socializing and stuff like that. But when you spend 8 hours in a drafting room drawing, that's a little different deal. Especially, again, I grew up out in the country and was outside a lot. And so, being in that environment just didn't fly.
I imagine high school, that job was better than flipping burgers.
Oh, yeah. 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 Well, again, we grew up on the farm and, baling hay for the neighbors or what have you. And, we had some livestock of our own when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the kind of thing that was going to suit me.
So, what was your, out of high school, what did you do then?
Well, initially I went to Cincinnati Technical College.
Okay.
And actually I was trying to harp off on my drafting because when I graduated from high school, CAD was just coming around. So that was computerized aided drafting.
Yeah.
We didn't have a system in vocational school. I think they got it the next year, but I heard enough about it that I was interested. So I decided I was going to go to Cincinnati Technical College and take just the CAD course. Well, there were prerequisites to that. And so by the time it was all said and done, I found myself fully in a full out commitment on a full-time college at Cincinnati Tech. So initially I was majoring in civil engineering construction. Went there my first term, made the dean's list, and I was in high school, I was a good student as far as grades went, but I only got as good of grades as I cared to get.
Right.
So
same here.
But so I was bearing down a little bit. So I go to Cincinnati Tech for a term and make the dean's list, and then I quit and I went to Florida for 6 months with a friend who was in construction. His dad was in construction. And they were doing a startup down there. So I went down there for about 6 months in Fort Lauderdale and learned that I didn't want anything to do with construction. So I came back and went back to Cincinnati Tech and took electromechanical engineering. And that's what I got my degree in.
Okay.
And so my career since then has kind of, you know, bounced off of that, working in mostly in facility and equipment maintenance.
Okay, so, and... What are you with the same company? Are you on your own? Or
oh no, I've bounced around a little bit. My first 10 years of my career, I worked at Hillshire Farm and Cons down in northern Kentucky, as a maintenance technician for a couple years, and then I became a supervisor, and was there just shy of 10 years. And I left there and went to United Dairy Farmers Ice Cream Plant in Norwood,
really,
and became the. I went there as a trainer, a technical trainer, and then I did some engineering there, and then I became the plant maintenance manager. So I was there for about 6 years, left, did a short stint at a company called Atkins and Pierce, which is a braiding company that started, you know, over 200 years ago in down on 3rd Street in Cincinnati, and then moved to Independence. When down there on 3rd Street built up to what it is, you know, it was starting to, all the factories were going away down there, right? So I was there for about a year and a half, left there and went to work for the U.S. Playing Card Company in Norwood, and worked for them for about 12 years. And in that time, we moved that plant from Norwood to Erlanger. And, you know, that whole time I was in manufacturing maintenance, and supervisory and management roles. And then once my youngest, that was a great job for when my kids were little, because it gave me an opportunity to be home, you know, every night to coach my kids in sports and that kind of stuff. And, when my youngest went to college and my wife and I were finding the house a little bare, I decided I could step out a little bit with my career, and an opportunity came up, and I actually went back to United Dairy Farmers Ice Cream Plant again.
Really?
Yeah. And I was there for about 4 years and left, and about a 4 year stint at a company called Flavor Producers, makes flavorings in Sharonville. And currently, I'm the regional operations manager for Brighton Mills, and we blend flour mixes for the restaurant industry.
Okay. Any of the companies, was it any one being your favorite, or for the work environment or the socialization or whatever?
The one I have now is my favorite.
Oh, okay, yeah. But let's say prior to that.
So prior to that, no, and that's seriously true. The company I work for is, I'm extremely happy there, and to this point, it's the best job I've ever had.
Really?
Outside of it was probably U.S. Playing Card. It was a great team. It was a great team, and really the only reason I left there was I was kind of stagnant there. The plant had moved, and again, my home life was a situation where I didn't necessarily need to be quite so stable, as far as, you know, I longer hours would have been okay and that kind of stuff. So,
well, with the company you're with now, is there any problems with, because of the inflation and the lack of help in the restaurant industry? Is business still good, or is it tough?
Business is pretty good. Business is growing, but we struggle with labor just like everybody else.
Really?
I mean, it's a constant problem
that
everybody's seeing.
I'll tell you, I don't know how these restaurants are going to survive. The high-end restaurants will, because that's where the big tippers are.
Right.
But
well, it's where the higher class people are going to eat, and it's the middle class and middle lower class, the ones that are just not going to be able to afford to go out,
and the poor,
and they're not going to go to these smaller lower end restaurants, right?
Oh man, it's tough though.
And I look at the cost of food, you know, material supplies for the restaurants. You know, we our church fries chicken, you know, every year, right?
Yeah.
And just the cost of frying oil is just unbelievable. And to think that all these restaurants are seeing those prices and having to deal with that every day. Yeah. And it's interesting to see how they're struggling through it.
Yeah. Well, even the pizzas, I think the large pizza boxes went from 40 cents, 30 or 40 cents to a buck.
Right.
And I mean, and when they're talking inflation, 8.2%, they forgot to add on the 7.5% from last year, bringing it up to almost 16%.
Well, and you're seeing it again. You're seeing it in the prices. You know, if you go to the fast food places and get a meal, the price is phenomenal, right?
Yeah.
And but listen, what they're having to pay for labor, you know, you got starting rate at McDonald's is 15 plus an hour just in order to get people in the door, right?
Yeah. So. And I noticed we always buy, you know, a couple things of butter from Costco, and haven't paid any attention, but I was in Kroger one day and I walked by the dairy counter and it, $4.99 for a pound of butter.
It's amazing.
You know,
the cost of eggs right now, it's up 30%, right?
Oh, so yeah.
These are staples. And
I think a lot of people are buying good sale price meats. They're grilling out, taking turns, going to a friend's house. And some of these small restaurants are really, really hurting.
Exactly.
And if they don't have the staff, they're short hours, everything. But it's a tough situation, and we'll see what happens on Election Day.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is coming out after Election Day, our podcast. Yeah. So, Are you working is it a 9-to-5 situation or 8-to-4?
Well, I've always been an early bird, so I usually start about 6:30 in the morning.
Oh, really?
Hopefully I'm out by 3.
Okay.
I had some software training this afternoon, so I was there a little bit later, so I came straight here from work, but that worked out fine.
So you're, the balance, the family balance and everything, you're there. That's no.
Oh, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah.
Yep, that's good. So, I'm around Robin as much as I think she wants me around.
Well, and when you you've been with this company 4 years now?
The company I'm with now, I've only been there since February.
Oh, since February. Okay. Yeah. So when you switch to a company like that, are they still generous with vacation time or not? Are they?
Well,
you got to be there a year.
Well, you know, there's certain things like the 401k is usually a technical thing. So, you know, I can't contribute to that till I've been there for a year. But most of that other stuff is negotiable.
Really? As far as vacation and time and such?
So, yeah. So I negotiated vacation time. And you know, I've been at this 35-some years. So it's not like if I'm going from one company to another, I'm not going to give up that, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, I've never been one to need a whole lot of vacation. You know, I had one job that I had 4 weeks vacation. That was US Playing Card. Right before I left, I got 4 weeks vacation.
That's great.
And then the other jobs I went into, I went in and negotiated 3. And so it all works out. You know, if you can't work it out, then you just stay put, wait for the next opportunity, right?
Yeah.
So.
And you don't do any of your work is not done at home, is it? Just all in the office? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, again, I'm in facility and equipment maintenance, so yeah. Usually, you know, there. I mean, you know, in the heart of COVID, there were some days where, you know, I worked from home, okay. Managed to work from home here or there, but it was never like weeks at a time or even a week at a time.
Okay. So let's talk a little about your hobby.
Which one? I've got a few, but...
Well, we know about... Well, if I didn't mention this, but you're part of the Cross the Line 1524 podcast. Yeah. But I'm talking about your beekeeping hobby.
The beekeeping.
Yeah. Again, we talked about this before, but explain how you got started and what your goal is, how you keep those poor little creatures alive over the winter, and... Just a general, you know, we all like honey, and we know that bees make honey, but we don't know what it takes for them to do it and do it big time.
Well, we'll start with me getting into beekeeping, and it goes back to my father. So my father was actually a World War II vet. Him and my mom grew up in Cincinnati, and they moved out to Indiana in like 1952.
Okay.
So, you know, so I'm on the very youngest edge of that baby boomers thing, you know?
Yeah.
And actually I have, five siblings, the oldest of which was about 20 years older than me and was married before I was born.
Whoa.
So my father grew up in Western Hills and Price Hill, actually. But back when he grew up, Delhi was farmland, hunting land. That was his hunting area, right?
Yeah.
And so he always enjoyed the outdoors and the woods and the farms. And so after the war, him and my mom tried a couple small businesses in Cincinnati, and he decided he wanted to get out of the city. And so they bought a little 86-acre farm and an old log house that he put back together. And he started, you know, farming a bit, raising some beef cattle and chickens and you name it. He tried a little bit of everything and bees. So when I was really little, we had beehives on the property.
Did your father know anything about bees before he decided to do it?
Probably no more than he knew about growing tomatoes, you know, from a farm standpoint or raising cattle. Yeah. But my dad, he was he never graduated high school, but he was the smartest man I ever knew.
Okay.
And so nothing like that, you know, would hold him back as not learning, you know, that he could learn that. So he did that stuff, Larry. But here I come along at he's 41 years old when I'm born. So by the time I got old enough, and he never gave up his factory job in Cincinnati. So he drove back and forth to Cincinnati every day. And by the time I got old enough that I'd have even been interested in the bees, he was kind of just, that was the least mm-hmm. interest there. He had cattle he was dealing with and sheep. We had sheep when I was small and that kind of stuff. So the bees were kind of an offset. And back then you could just let honeybees go and they'd be in that hive year after year after year.
Really?
That really doesn't happen now anymore with it. Mites and the viruses that are around. So
yeah. I'm surprised. I mean, I just thought at the end of the season that they'd go off and die somewhere.
No. So anyway, so we didn't really mess with bees when I was a kid. I wasn't that interested with the other things that we were doing. And then I married my wife, Robin, and her dad retired in 1994 or 5. And he was the kind of guy that always had to have a new hobby. Kind of like you, Larry.
Yeah.
The next new thing come along, you got to jump on it, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe we'll have you beekeeping before this is over.
Oh, I don't know about that one.
So anyway, he decided to get it and try beekeeping. Yeah. And so when we would go visit, I would kind of from afar kind of see what was going on with his bees. And again, I had some background in my dad having had bees. And then in 1998, in one of my job moves, gave my wife and I the opportunity to move from Northern Kentucky back out home.
Oh, wow.
So we bought some property from my mother, and we built a house on the home place. Then I had an opportunity to try beekeeping myself. So that was kind of the start of getting me into beekeeping. It was a combination of my dad and my wife's dad.
Wow. Well, now, again, I guess when you're doing a mass beekeeping thing, do you still call them hives, or you call them something else?
No, you call them hives. So the hive is that single unit that colony lives in.
Okay.
That's a hive. And then what they call a group of hives is an apiary. Okay, so Apis mellifera, that's the typical scientific name for honeybees, so it's an apiary.
Okay, so how many do you have?
I've at last count, I think we were right around 40 colonies, 40 hives.
And about how many bees are in a colony?
In the height of the summer, each colony will have around 60,000 bees.
In one colony?
In one colony, in the height of the summer.
And you've got 40 of them?
Yeah, it's a lot of bees.
Whoa. How much honey do they produce, or is it based on a weather factor?
Well, the colony's production is based a lot on weather and just what the bloom is. Okay, just depends. In year after year, it's totally different. So this year was a really good year. We had a decent spring. Around here, the first big bloom for honeybees is black locust. That's the first big nectar supply for honeybees.
Really?
Yeah. And the previous couple years, we didn't have a very good black locust bloom because we had some weird late freezes.
Mm-hmm.
And then different things bloom just week to week, right? If you think about the season of things that are the plants that are flowering, is every week it's something a little new and something a little new. And then usually around here, around the end of June, mid-July, most of the big nectar flow is over.
Okay. So when I know the honey drips down, you have to collect the honey. Do you have to do anything other than bottle the honey, or is it just all raw honey, or how does that all work?
Well, so typically what, you know, beekeepers in this part of the world do is the hives are constructed in such a way that you pull frames out and it has a comb on it with capped honey. You cut that capping, that wax capping off of the honey. And in our case, we have a centrifuge that we put those frames in, and we spin that honey, and it slings the honey out of the comb, and then it runs down, and that's how we get our honey.
So there's no dilution of the honey at all? I mean, there's no other ingredients. It's just pure honey.
Just pure honey.
Okay. So a good year, I guess, what are they, 8-ounce, 12-ounce bottles? Or?
So we typically are handling 1-pound bottles and 2-pound bottles.
16 ounces. Okay. So how many, with the number of bees that you have, that's what, 2.4 million?
I've never run the numbers, but it's a lot of bees.
Okay. How much honey can you get in a good season? Like you said, this was a good season.
This was a good season. Rob and I weren't really pushing hard for honey this year. If we'd have pushed harder, we'd have got more, but we extracted about 950 pounds. So I would say our best hive, we probably took near to 200 pounds off of.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. And not certainly not all of them that much. That was one hive that just boomed and took off like crazy. And we were working that one for honey production.
Okay.
The other ones we weren't.
So when you bottle it, I presume you have your own label.
Yep.
And what's the label say?
Hoosier Creek Farm.
Hoosier Creek Farm.
That's the name of our honey. Yep.
Our, where do you sell it?
So we sell it from home, word of mouth a lot. We go to just a few other events. We have a Maple Fest, I think you're familiar with, that we go to every year, and we set up there and do well with that. And here recently, we were down at the Aurora Farmers Fair, but that was a whole club event. So we belong to a beekeeping club here in Sunman, Indiana, Southeast Indiana Beekeepers Association. And that group gets together every year, and they go down and they have a booth down there, and it promote just to promote the local honey and beekeeping. And then, you know, we can sell our honey down there.
Okay. I've got a crazy question. I asked Alan this and said, you know, like when we have bourbon tastings, I said, do you have maple tastings? And he says, yeah, it's all good. Do they do that with honey, or does all the honey taste the same?
No.
Okay.
No, I could bottle, you know, some honey, you know, a few times a year, and each of that would taste, you know, quite a bit different.
And you
have to kind of taste it side by side, like a lot of other tastings, to really catch the difference. So there's people that really like the early spring honey because it's usually a milder and a little bit sweeter flavor. It's usually a little lighter in color. And I don't fool with fall honey so much, but the later you get in the year, for whatever reason, the honey tends to be darker. And then you get in the fall, people that are going to be pulling honey off now, if they pulled honey off earlier in the year, it's going to be a pretty dark honey, and it'll be a much stronger flavor.
Really?
And some people prefer that. Some people don't.
Okay. Do locations make any difference?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. So all beekeeping's local, and it just depends on what's going on around you. And a lot of times people think farmland's great, but if it's all cropland, especially corn produces no nectar. It's all, that's all wind-blown pollinated. We actually do better in the woodland areas where there's more wildflowers growing. Again, I mentioned the black locust, maple in the early part of the spring is a good production.
Okay, how about by the states? Is there some states that are more productive, or are, like, if you go into a supermarket and I don't know what the brands are anymore, but if you pick something up at a supermarket, is it going to have the same quality?
No. So if you're talking about big brand name honeys, here's the problem, is they're probably not from your area, and they may be adulterated. There's been a lot of issues with honey coming from overseas and from China, which it's illegal for honey to come from China, but one of the largest food crimes in the United States had to do with honey that was coming from China.
Jeez.
It was, it's amazing, but honey's kind of a difficult thing because they're getting better at testing it. But a lot of honey's on the shelf, and you know, Alan will tell you this about maple syrup too. You got to watch it. A lot of the honeys on the grocery store shelves is mostly corn syrup and a little bit of honey.
Really?
And so on and so forth. Yeah. So one of the stickers that I put on my honey, it says, how do you know it's real honey unless you know the beekeeper? So, you know, that's one of the things we promote is get your honey from someone you know, from a beekeeper you know, preferably, and get it fairly local to you. I mean, that's where, you know, people talk a lot about the health benefits of honey, whether it be allergies or other things, and it makes a big difference that it's relatively local. and regions are different. So when I say local to Batesville, we're talking, you know, within 50 miles mm-hmm. or so, because the flora is pretty much the same throughout that region, right? So that's where you get the benefits, especially for people who eat honey for their allergies.
I had no idea, because in the spring, you know, the pollen, I have to shoot nose drops in every morning because I'm really...
Well, you need to get on a honey regimen.
And how would you do that?
I've been fortunate throughout my life. I've not had a lot of trouble with allergies, so I can't speak personally to it, other than people that buy honey from me specifically for their allergies swear by it. And so if you have spring allergies, you're going to want to get a honey that is going to contain that came from nectars from those spring flowers okay. that are around. And from what I'm told by those people, they'll start a regimen in January of just a teaspoon a day. Teaspoon of honey a day, every day.
Just straight, or put it on something? Or
either or. Doesn't matter. Some people will mix it in their tea. Some people will just take a teaspoon. Some people put it on their toast, right?
Really?
So, yeah. So, I have a few people that buy honey from me, and they swear by it. I had one young lady years ago who had gotten some honey from me, and she was a friend of mine's daughter-in-law, and she was a bit of an athlete. She was a soccer player, and I went to visit, and she happened to be at my friend's house when I was there, and she came out and gave me a big hug, and I said, "What's this about?" She said, "Your honey." She said, "It's the first year I've ever been able to breathe." Talking about the spring. So, but then I've got other people that, you know, they tell me that too. Again, I can't speak to that personally, because I've not really ever had a problem with allergies.
Yeah. Well, the only thing I'm allergic to is pollen in the spring. Cats. I like cats, but
I can't help you with the cats.
Boy, I tell you, if we could be in church, we could be anywhere, and if somebody's sitting close to me that has cats, I mean, my throat starts swelling. It's awful. And
then there's other people that have those fall allergies. They would want a honey that is produced in the fall, which there's less of that around here. My wife and I don't deal with the fall honey, because we're more focused on allowing the bees to pack what they need in the fall away to get them through the winter.
Well, let's take a little water break here and collect our thoughts, because this is very interesting to me, and I'm sure it is to everybody listening, because I just never dreamt. I thought honey was honey. And
so there's two things I always tell people. Number one, there's no such thing as a five-minute conversation about honeybees. I've never had a conversation about honeybees in less than 5 minutes.
You can't, because nobody knows anything
about
it.
And the more that I learn about honeybees, the more I realize I don't know. And I think that's really the way worldwide the beekeeping scientists say the same thing. They learn new things every day about honeybees.
I'm just fascinated. We'll be right back. We're just going to take a little break, so be right back.
Thank you.
Okay, we're back now. So, exploring this a little further. Again, I don't even, what does a pound jar of or a pint of honey cost? What's retail?
Our one pound bottles are $9, and our 2 pound are $16.
Oh, that one.
And you'll find it, you know, higher than that. You'll go to the grocery store, and again, you'll find this stuff, the brand name stuff on the shelf for $5 or something like that. That's telling you something.
But it's not honey.
Well,
I mean, I can't imagine something saying honey and it's corn syrup. Most of it's corn syrup.
Yeah, it's hard to. The testing is very difficult to be able to put it down and say that it's not honey.
Really?
But one thing they watch for actually is, and what China would do would, because they can tell where honeys come from with regard to their pollen residue through genetics, right?
Really?
So what China got real good at was ultra filtering their honey so that you couldn't freaking make any distinction of where it came from. And that's something that now they actually watch for, is when it's ultra filtered like that, to where they have can't read what the pollen residues are, and then they can't figure out where it came from.
I just figured they could catch all that, because one thing I always admired about Kraft, I love Velveeta on a burger, but they always said it's a cheese food. They didn't pretend it was cheese.
Right.
And now let's get into, tell me what happens to the bees in the winter now.
Well, first you asked me the question about how much honey do the bees produce.
Yeah.
So a single honeybee will produce less than a teaspoon of honey in its lifetime. So if you think about a pound of honey, how many bees' lives went into that pound of honey? That's why the colony has to have 60,000 bees.
Wow.
And they're turning over those bees all the time. So one of the amazing things is the queen, of which typically in a colony there's only one laying queen, in the height of the spring and early summer, she will be laying between 1,500 and 2,000 eggs a day. Jeez. And it takes 21 days from an egg to develop into an emerged worker honeybee.
Yeah. Supermom. My.
The other really crazy thing is she only mates once in her life. She emerges, and about a week or so later after she emerges, she goes on mating flights. She actually flies in the air, and drones, which are the male bees from all different colonies, they collect in areas out in the fields and the woods. They have drone collecting areas. It's kind of like the guys hanging out at the bar, you know, kind of thing. And when a queen goes flying by, the drones will take off in a little swarm chasing her, and she will be mated by anywhere from 7 to 25 drones.
Oh, my.
And then she returns back to her hive, and about a week later she'll start laying eggs. So she stores the sperm from that one mating for her entire life. And a queen can live, typically they're replaced, they probably don't live more than 2 years.
Really?
Typically. They can live up to 5 years, 4 or 5 years. But if you think about that, laying 15 to 2,000 eggs a day is pretty amazing. And then drones come from unfertilized eggs. So the drone bee is actually a product of an unfertilized egg, and it has 100% of the genetics of the queen. and the queen can determine whether that egg is going to be fertilized or not when she lays it.
Wow. That's fascinating. It really is.
Yeah. And it's the tip of the iceberg. There's just so many amazing things about honeybees. So as far as what happens now, so as we're recording this, it's mid-October. Mm-hmm. The honeybees have pretty much collected all the nectar and the honey they're going to get. So what they've got has got to get them now through the winter. And so the queen is backed off laying, probably late September or even after a lot of colonies, as soon as the nectar flow kind of backs off, the queen backs off laying. And so they are reducing their colony size. They're kicking drones out because drones do nothing but eat and make queens. Drones don't even have stingers, so they can't even defend the hive.
Really?
Right. So they kick the drones out of the hive. Most of my colonies right now would not have any drones in it at all.
Wow.
So they're backing off and backing down and just getting ready for winter. And then she'll take a period kind of between now and the end of December where they're not going to raise much in the way of brood at all. And then early to mid-January, she will start laying some eggs inside that cluster to start to reproduce some bees to take over the bees that now are going to be a few months old. So the bees that are alive now need to make it a few months, as opposed to in the summertime where their lifespan's about 6 weeks. So now they got to make it a few months to get through the winter.
Wait a minute. So the bees in your colony, they hit old age 6 months and kick it. They're done.
Well, the bees in from the spring and during the nectar collection period of time is about 6 weeks. Six, 7 weeks, 8 weeks. They just work themselves to death. They're working that hard. So now their metabolism is back. They've produced the bees this time of year a little bit differently with what we all call fat bees. They're fat bees to get them through the winter. And so they're prepping. They're just prepping to get through the winter at this point.
Wow. So, and where do they hang out in the winter? Do they stay in their hives?
They stay in their hive, and what they do is when it gets the colder it gets, the tighter they'll cluster into a ball inside their hive.
And that's how they keep warm?
That's how they keep warm. They vibrate their wing muscles to create heat, and they'll cluster into a tight ball. And in the center of that tight ball, regardless of how cold it is outside, it typically in winter with no brood, it's probably not going to get below 75 degrees. Come January, when that queen starts laying, they will drive that core temperature, that cluster, up to 90, 94 degrees.
In January?
Give or take a degree.
Wow.
And they'll hold it there because that's the temperature they need to develop their brood. And they'll maintain that temperature from there on out in the center of that cluster around that brood, and it doesn't matter if it gets 10 below zero, it's going to be 94 degrees in that center of that cluster.
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
I mean, they always say, without bees, we would really have some worldwide problems. And kind of explain that, because I know you need honey, but I just don't realize maybe how much you need.
Well, so the biggest job of the honeybees is pollination,
yes.
Right? And that's where economically, that's where the biggest money is if you're a commercial beekeeper. Commercial beekeepers, whether I know some in northern Indiana or they're in Florida or wherever they are, come this January, late December, January, they're going to be hauling semi-truck loads of beehives to California to pollinate almond trees. The almonds bloom in February, like February, March, I guess, out there. And if you think about the pollen or the almond industry, where almonds have gone, you've got almond milk and almond flour and almond this and almond that.
Is that due to the bees?
Well, that's not due to the bees. Yep. It's due to people using almonds as a resource, as an alternative to other things, right? So in California, they can't plant almond trees fast enough. And California produces, from what I understand, about 90% of the world's almonds.
Wow.
Okay. And they don't have enough honeybees to pollinate them. They don't have a lot of other pollinators that pollinate almonds.
Okay, but without the bees pollinating the almonds, that's what I meant by producing there.
Right.
Then they're just not going to
have They're not going to produce crop. Almonds. Right, yeah. They're not going to have good crops. And they pay big money to rent honeybees in California. So these guys haul truckloads, semi-truckloads. You'll hear every once in a while, you hear about a semi-truckload of bees wrecked on the highway, and there's honeybees everywhere. Well, they were either going or coming from probably California. And a lot of those guys will haul honeybees to California that time of the year, and then they'll go up the coast, and before they haul them back here, they'll have been up into Oregon and Washington State pollinating apple trees and stuff like that.
So they pollinate most of the fruit trees?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of other pollinators. There's a lot of other bees, like in this area, you know, there's a lot of other bees that pollinate trees and plants. But the honeybees are farmable. Okay. So, and then the big problem that came in the 80s and 90s were, some mite issues. Mites that came from foreign countries, and the honeybees, first of all, honeybees aren't native to the United States or to this continent, to North America. They came from Europe.
Okay.
Back in the days of the pilgrims, basically, they were bringing honeybees on the ships over here. And it was, you know, it was a perfect place for the honeybees because they could split and swarm and become feral in trees, and they just, when I was a kid, when you were a kid, you could go out in the woods and find a tree with honeybees in it.
Yeah.
And that was quite common. Nowadays, that's not so common because of the mite issues that came that showed up in the '80s and really devastated the honeybee industry in the United States.
Wow. That's so when I asked you about hobbies, I'm sure you don't have time for any more hobbies.
Well, it started as a hobby, and it got to a point I wasn't very good at it early on. My bees were dying, so I started. I think it like I said, 98 or 99 is when I got a couple colonies, and they would do fine in the summer and fall, and you know. Didn't know much about them, the little bits. Read magazine articles and that kind of stuff. And so I did, you know, several years. And I even got to a point where, you know, I quit. I was done because I was tired of having to buy bees to replace the ones that didn't make it through the winter or didn't make it, you know, through the spring. And one summer I had two hives that had died out in the mid spring, and I just left them. I was done, and a swarm moved into one of them, and so I just decided, okay, we'll see what happens here. I'm not going to mess with them. I'm just going to watch them, and I'll be darned if they didn't make it through the winter. And in the spring, they were ready to split, so I split them, and now I had two colonies, and kind of took them through the summer. In the meantime, a friend of mine pointed me to this. The Southeast Indiana Beekeepers Association here locally. And I started going to those meetings, and it was just a great group. And they had their focus in the right place, and they got my focus in the right place. And the only problem with that is once you learn how to keep bees alive, you end up with way too many of them.
So, well, when you like your harvest this year, will you sell all of your product before your harvest next year?
I doubt it.
Really?
Yeah. My downside is I'm not a very good marketer, Larry. So my marketing side doesn't keep up with the supply side. That's, yeah, a lot of times that's not a business person's biggest problem.
But shelf life is good, I'm sure.
Shelf life for honey. Honey is about the only food that never goes bad.
Okay.
So, one of the stories you'll hear is they found edible honey in the pyramids that they figure was 10,000 years old. So the pH of honey is about 3.5. Okay. So it's very acidic, and it's less than 18% humidity. So it basically, bacteria cannot grow in it. And as a matter of fact, they use honey now in healing wounds. They actually have wound packs that are that have honey in them for the healing benefits. Yeah.
Wow. Well, it's interesting, and time has really.
See, you get on honeybees, and you can forget everything else.
Yeah, I know. I mean, well, I'll tell you, I've learned more tonight about honeybees than I ever dreamed of. And I would imagine probably 99% of my friends know absolutely nothing about bees. And when they go to a store, they're just like me. If you pick up a jar of honey, you say, well, it's honey. But
yeah, it's not the case.
It will never happen again. I will buy honey from you and Dwayne.
There you go. More than happy to supply you that.
Yeah.
So, and you talk about the agriculture, and before we get off of that, and you'll hear people say when the honeybees go extinct, that's the end of us. Well, the fact of the matter is I'm pretty comfortable to say the honeybees aren't going to go extinct. We'll go extinct before honeybees go extinct.
Really?
The problem is this, is that our world is so hungry and needs so much agriculture. The only way we can manage is with lots and lots of managed honeybee colonies to pollinate all that food for us.
Wow.
If we disappeared off the face of the earth, honeybees, there wouldn't be near as many colonies, but they would go on and survive for eons.
Yeah. Wow, that's interesting. Well, we're approaching 55 minutes here, so I think we better wrap it up. It's been a real pleasure.
Sure.
Gained a lot of knowledge tonight. You're never too old to learn.
I wish I could be like you and just jump on every little opportunity that comes along, Larry. So here,
I get bored easily.
Well, my career path is kind of where my career path took me. Yours is where every opportunity that came in front of you took you, because you just jump on every opportunity.
Well, I said on another podcast, I forget which one, but in business, in both my jobs out of the service, in the service, that was always in my comfort zone. Three things been out of my comfort zone. Two, writing books that I didn't think I had the skills to do it, and sitting in front of a computer 5 hours a day for 4 months just kind of drove me crazy. And doing a podcast, I thought, I don't want to edit. I want to make it real. I want people to feel like they're sitting at a table and we're talking, and they're right there listening. And so constantly, as my wheels are turning, I do enough and things like that. But at least it's real and it's fun.
Right.
And I've had so many interesting guests, and I had a guy text me the other day and said, "Are you looking for more guests?" And this is a Wall Street guy. He said, "I know some people." I said, "I'm not interested in talking to Wall Street people." No, he said, "I know some normal people." So anyway, and that's what it's all about, to have interesting guests where people could be entertained, and they also learn something. Learn something about people, because the average Joe in America is the salt of the earth. And, you know, the Ivy Leaguers and the guys that have to, every time they get a promotion, they have to go out and build a new house or have three or four houses. That's not the real America. I mean,
well, Larry, I tell you, I hope you have as much fun with your podcast as, you know, shameless plug as I've had with our Cross the Line 1524 podcast. Again, not in my comfort zone. I kind of got on that in the back end. I thought those guys were crazy. You know, so the guys that we got into that, and it's taken me places, taken us places that we didn't think we'd be. And to be quite honest with you, I'm sitting here tonight because of our podcast, and that's where I met you.
Right.
And so I hope that this podcast builds more of those friendships that you never thought you'd have, like our podcast has done for us.
Oh yeah, and the nice, I talked to Alan when we were doing a podcast, and sometime when it's nice and cold out, we're going to have a dual podcast from the speakeasy, and I'll be here, and I might have one of my sons or somebody on.
That'd be great.
We'll just go back and forth, and we can talk whiskey, guns, whatever anybody wants to talk about.
All that stuff you sit around and talk about at the bar, and that's where it started, and absolutely, that's kind of how we try to keep our podcast, yeah, is just a conversation and light.
And you want to make it not only fun, like I'm having fun, and I'm really kind of getting into a comfort zone now.
Well, good.
But we want the guests to have fun. But before we hit an R and I go jump into another section that, you know, I don't want to split this in two. So, Jeff, I really appreciate you being here. And it's time to sign off. I want to thank everybody for listening. And just remember, faith, friends, family, country, everything else is background music. God bless you. God bless the United States of America. I'll talk to you on my next podcast. Thanks again.